Welcome to the Cynica Podcast, a weekly discussion of current affairs in China, coming to you from the pop-up Chinese studio here in Beijing. I'm Kaiser Guo, joined as usual by sower of discord Jeremy Goldcorn, the man behind Danway.com. How are you this evening, Jeremy?
Very well indeed. I've seen green shoots in the trees in Chiang Park.
Ah, really?
Not even Spring Festival.
It's kind of uncanny how that Chinese lunar solar calendar is kind of accurate, right?
It does seem to work. I don't know if we just notice when it works and we don't notice when it doesn't. But
yeah, so Li Chun is, was a couple of days ago, and it is noticeably warmed. It was a really unusually warm winter here in Beijing.
Unusually warm and actually pretty good as far as pollution goes. Yeah, Shanghai had a much worse winter than Beijing, I think.
Anyway, we are very happy today to welcome back James Palmer, who's written a piece that's gotten quite a bit of attention since it ran last week. It's called The Bro Code, Booze, Sex, and the Dark Art of Deal-Making in China.
And I think I preferred the way you tweeted it, which was business and fucking in China or something like that.
Well, of course you like that, and you, Mr. Perfume.
I like my blunt subtitles, yes, but, you know, the China file was decided to go a little more discreet.
Right, it appeared first on the estimable China file, and then later on the somewhat less estimable Vice. Anyway, welcome back, James.
Thank you for having me, Kaiser. We actually had a choice of whether to run it with Foreign Policy or with Vice, and I thought Vice was just more appropriate all round for this particular piece.
Yeah, being, after all, about Vice.
Exactly.
And having nothing whatever to do with foreign policy.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I don't know what they get up to on diplomatic trips, but...
So, it's a great piece, and I think by now everyone who's listening will have read it, so
give us a small introduction. What's in it, you know?
So it breaks down what you have to do, basically, to be part of Chinese business culture. That is, you have to go out with fellow men. You have to participate in this kind of culture of drinking and whoring, and in some cases drugs, though I didn't mention that at great length in the piece.
That's essentially, talk a little bit about ketamine.
That's essentially designed to test your sort of trustability. And there's so few ways in China to trust the people you're doing business with, because the laws are so uncertain. The state of business and contracts is so dubious. Particularly the more you get outside of Beijing and Shanghai, the more of a gray zone even regular business is. So what you have is practices that in other countries are largely the domain of criminal enterprises that have become part of normal Chinese business practice because there's so little other way, to sort of judge people or test people.
One thing I'd like to ask is, I mean, at the end of your piece, one comes away with the feeling that nobody's actually really enjoying this. I'd like to just question that a little bit. I mean, don't you think that part of it is also that, people like eating, drinking, and fucking, basically?
I say that in the piece at one point, you know. I mean, you know, booze, sex, drugs, they're fun, you know. But they're not fun when you're having to do them with 10 other guys. You know, there's a lot of things that's true for, but I think especially sex. Yeah. I mean, I have friends who would enjoy a pile of men, but that's
it's different.
You actually called around to a number of contacts in Tangshan and in Chongqing.
Yeah, I mean, just to sort of get a sense of what was happening. And because we've seen in a lot of previous crackdowns that they've been limited to the metropolises, but, you know, you go 5 miles outside of Beijing and the supposedly banned thing is still there. But this really has been much more across the board.
You touched on a really interesting idea, and I don't know if, I mean, maybe this is something I should be trying at work. You pointed out there was a meme circulating some years ago saying, let me see if I can get this right, it's better to do one bad thing with your boss than to do 100 good things for your boss. So that's what we're talking about here. It's sort of like having something to hold over their heads. I mean,
it's partially hostage information, but it's partially just that they feel that you're somebody they can trust, because it creates a sort of sense of shared complicity of like sharing a secret, sharing a thing.
But if it's so commonplace, how bad is it? I mean, does anyone really kind of have hold their nose at people who confess to having, you know, indulged in a little bit of hanky panky in the sauna?
Well, I think the commonplaceness of it is what makes it powerful, because it establishes that you're playing by the baseline. It's not like murdering a guy together. It's just,
oh, that's much better though.
Murdering a guy together is how you really get to know somebody. Right. But it just establishes he's one of us. He's right. Okay. And then you have this whole process of sort of testing the other side, seeing exactly what kind of person they're like.
How aware do you think people in China are outside of the business community, the people are doing this? How aware of this lifestyle are their wives, their children, their grannies?
It depends. A lot of the wives know. I mean, a lot of the wives are aware of it and feel conflicted over it. You get these cases where women go to psychologists saying, I can't accept my husband's cheating. Teach me to accept my husband's cheating. Or you have my friend who I cited in the piece where he's married to a Chinese woman who earned her own money, who's a multi-millionaire in her own right, and who said to him when they got married, I don't mind if you cheat as long as it's always for money, as long as you're always paying the girl, because she saw that as just part of what you had to do for business.
I see. It's just a mere commercial transaction in more than one sense.
Yes, and it's necessary, so vital to that sort of building that you get women, in fact, using their male partners to do it for them in some cases, or hiring men to sort of take it on. But in answer to just how common it or how commonly aware it is, I've known a lot of young Chinese women who haven't been aware of it up until the point where they suddenly have. So then there's suddenly been something that crystallizes for them. Oh my God, all this stuff is going on. And then they sort of see it.
On every street corner.
On every street corner, yeah. I mean, I remember when I first arrived in Hebei in 2003, and I was looking at all these, massage parlors as we drove along, and I asked the woman from the university, why are there so many brothels? And she said, I think they are only for foreigners. And this was a city that at the time had about 40 foreigners, and about, I would guess, 20,000 sex workers.
The 40 of you were busy.
We had a budget, from the government. It was funding. It was an important part of intangible cultural heritage. So, I had a friend who, she didn't believe me when I said that whenever I stayed in a Chinese provincial hotel at, 10, 11 o'clock, you would get
the phone call.
Mm. Or in one case, the literal foot, had somebody actually knock on my door, and the literal foot in the door. She was very persistent. I was like, I admired her salesmanship and her sheer physical force, but neither of these were going to compel me towards,
letting her in.
But she didn't believe this until she went to stay in a provincial hotel and her name got written down wrong. So it got
a male.
It got identified in a male form. So she started. She got all these this whole series of phone calls. And then again, for her, it was like, oh my God, this is everywhere.
It is interesting in China how if you don't know that it's there, it's easy to not see it. I took once your countryman Jeremy Paxman, the news presenter, to the Great Wall. Great Wall Fresh, my peasant friends, and he basically, his producer was trying to make them appear like oppressed villagers being oppressed by the government, and they didn't end up doing a story on it. But I spent quite a bit of time talking to Jeremy Paxman, and this topic at one point came up, and he was like, there are brothels? Yeah, I thought there were none. I thought they'd cleaned that all up after Chairman Mao, I think is something he said. But, I mean, it's not like Thailand or Cambodia, if you don't know what it is, you wouldn't notice it, would you?
It's in these funny forms, like spas, like hairdressers that don't have any scissors.
Let's talk about that. So there's a hierarchy, right, of sex workers here. I mean, and so maybe you start at the bottom from it goes all the way from your common street strumpet all the way to the kept woman, the very expensive mistress.
Yes,
right?
Yes. So there's this really good taxonomy of seven types of sex worker done by Pan Shui Ming, I think, at Renmin Dajia.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so at the lowest level, you have sort of older women who mostly serve migrant workers. And then as you go up, as you go up the rankings, it gets more indoors,
mm-hmm.
and it gets into more concealed or acceptable forms. So you have, I think sort of mid-level, you have like the barbershop, and then you have the KTV, for instance. Right. So the KTV is clearly above the barbershop because the barbershop is sort of serving casual walk-in customers, mostly poorer, mostly a migrant audience. I mean, there's two. One or two on my street now, and they have the that sort of poor, rundown look. And then the KDV is sort of a step above that because it's more expensive to run. You have to... The barbershop can be moved or closed down easily. That's another thing. So where I used to live in Tuanjohu, at one point it was a huge sex workers area, and that's now diminished over the course of the last few years. But there were, I guess, something like 6 or 7, massage places within 2 minutes of my building. And then they would close down when things tightened up, and then they would reopen or they would shift or this kind of thing. And now, actually, I gather, I moved a few months ago, but I gather that they're pretty much all gone. Yeah. So there's a whole... But the KTV is much harder to pick up because you need a place. You need a stronger... You need equipment. You need a stronger establishment. And then when you get up to the level of actual clubs or this kind of thing, then, of course, you've sunk a lot of money into it. So the further you move up to... Also, the more government contacts, the more of an established relationship with the authorities you have to have in order to protect this establishment. I mean, just take a Beijing example, Maggie's. The constant rumor was that it was PLA owned, and in fact, a lot of this stuff.
Police was the old rumor. Was that one of the co-founders was a Norwegian guy and a PSB guy had co-founded, was the rumor that I used to hear.
But a lot of these places are PLA owned. I mean, a lot of the high-end places were. I'm not certain how much that's still the case, but a lot of them were PLA owned because that gave the kind of protection that you needed to ensure that you could sink all this money in. And the places that weren't directly owned had strong established relationships with the authorities. So one of the things that we're seeing now with the crackdown is all those relationships, like all Chinese political relationships, have been shaken up, broken down. So it's going to take at least some time for them to be reestablished, and they're going to be reestablished in different forms if they are reestablished.
James, do we have any sense of just how big the sex industry is in China?
I've never seen a figure that, you know, I would trust. I think it's just impossible to tell. It's going to be enormous, I would think. Also because it's very hard to distinguish, because you have places that are mixed use. So you have places that are both legitimate spas and brothels. You have places that are both KTVs orientated towards sort of singing drunkenly with your friends, and ones that have hostesses. So it's hard to distinguish where that money goes into, you know, what that money counts as. Sure. I mean, there used to be a huge spa where I lived in Wudaukou, and it was family orientated. And you'd go in and there'd be sort of fathers and kids, and you went up to the 7th or 8th floor and there would be that whole kind of buffet section. But I went there once in the winter, and so I went to the spa because I wanted a hot bath. And then I went upstairs, and the extremely embarrassed manager, who was the only one who spoke English, came to me and she said, "Excuse me, but do you want special services? They are on the 4th floor." And I sort of looked at her, and it genuinely took me a moment to click, because I hadn't, because this place was so family friendly and sort of fun and orientated that it just hadn't even really occurred to me that there was an entire level of sort of the sex trade attached to it. So it's a little bit like if you went to Butlins and they also had hookers.
What is Butlins?
Oh, Butlins is a very English reference. Butlins is a sort of holiday camp for families and small children and fun times. I don't know what the US or Chinese equivalent to it is. It's yes.
How easy is it for someone to actually decide?
Actually, there's a lot of really good Chinese research into the sex industry. Renmin University has done just stellar work, interviews, all this kind of thing. But they've done just some really good, solid research. There's the really excellent one is Red Lights, which is Zheng Tiantian, which is about... She was an anthropologist, PhD student, and she spent, I think... something like 18 months, 2 years, working as a KTV girl in Dalian. And she didn't have sex with customers, but because the other girls would sort of protect her. And she describes just this terrifying, sort of feral environment where, you know, the police or local gangs would come in and rape the girls on a fairly regular basis, for instance, and the other girls would protect her from that. And it's an excellent book. It's a grueling book, but it's a brilliant, brilliant book, both in terms of... attitudes towards sort of masculinity and towards the actual details of the sex trade.
James, can I go back to something I raised at the top of the beginning of the show, which is how different is China from Korea, Japan, Vietnam?
I lived in Korea for a year, spent some time in Japan, but I'm not talking out of great experience with either of these, and I know nothing about Southeast Asia. But certainly in Korea it's there, but it's mostly drinking focused. In Korea, the drinking culture is very, very hardcore. To the extent that Korea is about the only country in the world, and this is not a joke, this sounds like a joke. Korean men, if you're sick, it's seen as a sign of weakness, of physical weakness, because all this stuff is kind of tied in with these weird ideas about masculinity and power and strength. So being sick is a sign of weakness, but a hangover is a legitimate business-related problem. So Korean guys who are sick will sometimes call into the office and say they have a hangover and can't come in.
Wow.
Yeah. So, but from what I saw of Korea, obviously there's plenty of sex work there, but it's not as big a part of the business experience. And also, Korea is, there's more ways to check that the other person is legitimate.
Right, it isn't a low trust environment that China.
Yeah, I mean it's not great. There's plenty of problems, but it's not to the same extent as China. And what I observed in Korea, a lot of the drinking, it wasn't inter business. So in China, most of it you're going out with people with whom you're maintaining relationships. But in Korea, it's more like, okay, everybody at work goes out together
with your boss
and gets drunk. Yeah.
And Japan is similar to that.
And in both cases, also, the drinking culture is so, honestly, so exhausting in itself. I don't think you have time for anything else afterwards. I mean, you're so...
Time or the ability,
perhaps.
The ability,
yes. You know.
After 7 bottles of soju.
In Korea, still, if you don't go out drinking, it's a social mark against you and it's hard to get promotion.
Right. This is one of the things that always used to... I always talk to friends who've gone to the U.S. to work, say, in Silicon Valley, you know, my Chinese friends, and they're always astonished. They grew up hearing these stories about the kind of debauchery that Americans tend to get, how promiscuous we are and all this. They find that suburban life in the Bay Area is entirely about, you know, lawn care.
You know, one of the things I think is there's a certain amount of getting the stupidity out of your system in the West. I mean, when you're 20 or 21, there's all kinds of aspects of UK drinking culture, party culture that I don't particularly like, but they're kind of a thing that you do when you're in your 20s and then you settle down and have family and so on, and you know, you still go out to the pub or whatever, but there's not that sort of hardcore, you know, we're gonna drink until we pass out. It's a kind of environment.
And you also tend to have sexual relationships very young.
Yeah, you
in the West, I mean, some people do, but I mean, generally society.
For myself, you know, it was a bleak wasteland when I was a teenager.
I'm not talking about my own teenage years, weren't great either, but if you look at the average, right, I mean, at what age do people in the West, in America or the UK, have their first sexual experience?
Yeah, I think it. I mean,
even Chinese university students often are having a bit of a tough time.
Well, I remember a couple of Chinese friends being shocked when they went to Western universities, particularly to Oxford or Cambridge, that there were bars in the university. That there was every Cambridge college has a bar, and they were genuinely shocked by this idea that you could have a bar in a university. You know, what was this? What kind of crazy decadence?
Don't you think there's also, I mean, just the fact that pornography, you know, if you see pornography and pornography is a crime in China, you know the crime has been committed. Whereas if you see a barbershop or you see a KTV, you don't know a crime has been committed. And there are, in fact, clean barbershops and KTVs. I mean,
yeah, I mean, the existence of legitimate establishments disguises the illegitimate ones. But also, let's be realistic here. Every young man in China has access to pornography. I mean, every, you know...
Everybody
every
young does. Man with a modem.
Every young man with a modem or who goes down to the local DVD seller. Chinese universities keep the bulletin boards and sort of servers there are stacked with pornography because they're maintained and run by young men. So, I mean, Tsinghua, Beida, every university has just terabytes of porn
Really?
Available to the students. Oh, God, yeah.
Terabytes of porn.
I've been musing an article, and I'm not joking here, this is at very early stages, but I've been musing an article on the vast popularity of Japanese pornography in China and how it affects the Sino-Japanese relationship.
Please write that. That is a fascinating subject that nobody has tackled. Write that, James.
I've had a lot of very embarrassing conversations with young male Chinese friends recently about this, just being like, so your tastes in pornography, tell me about them.
Write the article, James.
Well, what fascinates me about it too is that Japanese pornography has this very kind of domination, fake rape orientated sort of thing. I mean, it's quite unpleasant. So you have these guys who are simultaneously angry about the comfort woman issue, which has emerged, which has become so much more of an issue between China and Japan in the last sort of 20 years than it was before, too, in terms of official mentions, in terms of the way that people conceptualize it. So they yet are spending their time watching images of Japanese women being raped or being, you know, fake raped technically, but there's a whole sort of nexus of sex and nationalism and power here that I'm just beginning to dig at.
How does this whole culture play for Chinese business women?
So it's obviously very tough, but they have all kinds of ways to deal with it. So one way is to use male proxies, so to literally, in some cases, hire men to go out to do the drinking with them. Or they can go along and they can be the sort of, and they can switch into a sort of hostess role. So they can play this sort of, they can play the sort of role of the mama-san. They can, and this was something that I thought was unusual. People, when I talk to people, they call the proprietor of brothels mama-san.
Sure.
Like, it seems consistent across East Asia. I think it's just become established as like the clear word. So you get businesswomen who are sort of women in their 40s who will go along with their male colleagues, and then they'll be in the KTV or wherever, and they'll be like, and they'll be kind of a, why don't you pick her? She seems nice kind of thing. Or, but then also women sometimes establish alternate social networks themselves. So sometimes you'll get businesswomen who establish sort of social clubs, book clubs, this kind of thing, which in a much, honestly, a much nicer form, fulfill the same social function. They keep up social ties with other businesswomen. They build alternate networks. And the same goes for Christians, for instance. So you'll get Christian businessmen who, part of going to church, part of going to other churches is meeting with other Christian businessmen and building up their own sort of level of contacts. And of course, you get that everywhere. But in China, these things are slightly in deliberate contrast to the normal sort of male-dominated, vice-dominated world. You get, I think, you get women who just sort of put up with it, but you get a lot of complaints. You get a lot of anger about it. And I just have a lot of admiration for Chinese businesswomen because they have so much stacked against them and they're so fucking smart, you know.
So as is our habit, we will close the show out with recommendations. And again, as is our habit, we'll start with Jeremy. What do you have for us this week, Jeremy?
I got for you the WeChat public account of the Communist Party of China, which I read every day for the latest directives from Chairman Xi to make sure that I know what I'm supposed to be thinking. And it's good. It's just a daily dose of ideology.
So two things. Firstly, I wanted to recommend a really wonderful photo essay / infographic by Ian Johnson recently on basement dwellers in Beijing, which I completely forget the name of. It's a really good piece just about this one sort of basement and the ambitions and sort of aspirations of the people within it. And you get a sense of that sort of vibrancy and diversity of the people there. And, you know, you have people sending money back to help kids. You have people who've come because, you know, they're fanatics about race car driving or this kind of thing. It's such a good piece.
Sorry, I should just interrupt. I had it wrong. The name of the WeChat account I just checked on my phone is actually Communist Party member. Gong Chang Dang Yuan. That's the one you want to follow.
Jeremy is going to be quietly removed and rectified.
Yes, that probably. And also, you know what? If you're going to follow that, you have to follow the People's Daily also official WeChat account. Those two.
I know the guy who runs the People's Daily WeChat account. He'll be very happy.
Yeah, tell him I think he's doing a great job. He's really taking Xi Dada's message and communicating in ways that we new media people of the 21st century can understand.
I'm sensing a touch of irony over here.
No,
no. A smidgen.
James.
He says with that evil cackle. Now, James, you said you had a second recommendation.
Oh, so I also wanted to give a shout out to, in fact, a Seneca podcast veteran in the back room, Hudson Lockett, who's now running the China Economic Review and is basically writing every issue himself. And is really doing some fascinating work. Great stuff. You should check it out.
Yeah, I mean, you know, and to think he was a Seneca, you know, intern here.
And now he's running really Graham Earnshaw's flagship magazine. Graham, pay him more, for God's sake. Yeah, come good. On, I mean, he's running the whole magazine.
He's a great guy. I love that guy. Okay, great recommendations. Some time ago, a friend of mine named Tom Tobiasen, a lawyer in the Silicon Valley, spends a lot of time out here in China. You know, we're both history geeks. I mean, he's really deeply into history, and he gifted me a nice, thick, hardcover edition of The Landmark Herodotus. I don't know if you've seen this Landmark series, but they've done Herodotus, they've done Thucydides, they've done Xenophon. They've actually done the Hellenica, and they're going to do the Anabasis as well. They have Arrian, you know, the conquests of Alexander. Just amazing. These are so well-translated and thoroughly annotated, and there's like a map on every other page, so that, you know, everything that's referred to, every geographic location is just neatly mapped for you, and these really simple, easy to read maps, you know, which again and again, you know, it's the Aegean, it's the islands of the Aegean, it's the western coast of Anatolia, and it's of course the Greece, but you know, after 100 pages or so, you kind of get you finally figure out where everything fucking is. I mean, where all the different Cyclades are, and all. It's great. It's I've kept it at my bedside now for several months, and just read a few pages of it every night. But it's great stuff. It's edited by he's an unaffiliated academic named Robert Strassler, and this, the Herodotus, the one that I'm reading right now, the histories, is translated by Andrea Purvis, and it's a super simple, easy to read translation. So if you're a fan of the classics, if you like Greek history, I cannot recommend this more highly. And with that, bye. We'll see you next week. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week on the Cynic Podcast.